You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Prepare to enter a world of opposites. That's where a mega coal plant in India is classified as environmentally friendly technology, where electricity customers in Europe can buy credits from a coal plant as a clean development mechanism, where hundreds of millions of U.S. taxpayer dollars help build that deadly coal plant. We're going to travel to a small place in the big state of Madhya Pradesh in India. That's the sixth largest state with a population of 72 million people, right in the middle of the country. Our destination is the village of Sasan in the Singrauli district. There we'll find the Sasan Ultra Mega Power Project, one of four monster coal-generating stations being built by the Indian government. Unlike other big Indian coal plants, this one is not on the coast, ready to accept coal ships from Indonesia or Australia. The Sasan Power Project is fed by three Indian coal mines relatively nearby. Our guide today is Nicole Gio of Sierra Club India. Nicole, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
You've been to the Sasan Ultra Mega Power Project. What does it look like?
Massive. The first time I was there was in April of 2011, and at that point they had only completed construction on a very small part of the project, and it was already huge. I can't even really begin to describe it, but they cleared entire villages of people to make way for the project and build a border wall around the project itself. And that's just the power project. Reliance will not let us into the actual mine site, but I've been able to meet with communities that have been moved to make way for the overburden. This is just mountains and mountains of waste product from the mine itself, which is piled up, and just there's nothing holding it back. So boulders will just run down these piles, destroying homes where people used to live. And if there's any rain, any toxics, anything in those mounds will just run out into the water supply.
What a mess. What was there before this power project started?
Well, the history of Singrauli, that's the district that Sasan sits in, is a pretty dramatic one. It used to be densely forested. Actually, it was a place that people in many ways were afraid to go. It was the jungle. It was out there. But in the 1960s, they built the first large power project, the Rihan Dam. And since then, there have been numerous industrial projects, and people have been displaced multiple times. So many of the people have actually been displaced for Sasan. This isn't the first time they've even been displaced for a big industrial project.
And do they get compensation?
That depends. Under Indian law, as well as the IFC performance standards, which the U.S. Export-Import Bank is subject to, they should get compensation. We found reports of discrepancies with the compensation. There are various problems, people either being compensated at levels lower than required, or people who have not received their compensation. Either they were not compensated at all, or, you know, they've been told checks are in the mail, Reliant checks have been issued in the names of family members who are not around, who have died, who have disappeared. And by disappeared, I actually mean likely disappeared by the company. So that's been a huge problem that people are dealing with. And then in addition, if you have an entire family that's living on a small plot of land doing subsistence farming, which there actually were some people, if you ever go to Singrauli, you'll see why subsistence farming is very difficult there. But there were still people who were making a living that way. If they're lucky enough to have a title of their land, that will only be in one person's name. There'll be compensation for that one person, but not necessarily for the entire family that's living there. And then if they're relocated to a place where they're given a small amount of money and a place to live, but no land, they have no way to make an income. So as soon as that money runs out, they're pretty much done for.
The Sierra Club says this project is a killer. Why would you say that?
Well, coal-fired power plants, and this is just coal-fired power plants, not mines, estimates are that they kill around 100,000 people in India every year. So that's just a fact. And this is a massive coal plant. It is around 4,000 megawatts. The average U.S. coal plant is around 400 to 500. So we're already talking about a plant that's, the scale is almost unimaginable for people in the U.S. And that's going to be emitting a large amount of air pollution that's going to have devastating effects on the local population. And in addition, there's a huge amount of waste product from that. You have the ash pond, which villages have been moved for that. In the U.S., you have people drinking water that's contaminated from ash ponds here. When you're talking about a 4,000 megawatt coal plant in a district that's filled with coal plants that are multi-thousand megawatts, you have serious problems with water contamination. That's something they're already seeing. I mean, I have pictures of a woman who's using a hand pump to get water right next to the ash pond, like 20 feet from the edge of it. And that's her water supply. And then you get to the mine itself, and all of the damage that that's caused, both to the water supply and to the people that have been relocated for that project. And of course, then there's the people who've actually died. It can be hard to say that lung disease was caused from a specific coal plant. It's a lot easier to say there was a person who protested the relocation and disappeared, was picked up by the company, we know that, and then was not seen again. If you read the report, there's also people who've protested or complained whose children disappeared in the mine. We have accounts of workers who've died on the project itself. And so those are people who've actually died at the project. And in that sense, the project is very deadly.
How many units are now operating in Sisan, and has the Sierra Club worked out the carbon emissions from this place?
So the project is starting to come online now. There are 6 units total that will be operational. The carbon emissions are intense. I actually don't have the figures in front of me. It was hard for us to get many of those figures from the U.S. Export-Import Bank, which financed $900 million of financing for Sisan. Under federal legislation, as well as the Ex-Im Bank's own policies, they're required to release, upon request, various monitoring documents for the project, none of which they were willing to release to us. We were able to get a hold of the ESIA, the Environmental and Social Impact Assessment for the power project, only part of the ESIA for the mine, and then the greenhouse gas studies for both the mine and the power project. What's interesting is that Sisan actually violated Ex-Im's carbon policies at the time it was approved, and the bank initially rejected the project. They later reversed the decision when Reliance promised to install a few hundred megawatts of clean energy. And somehow that little bit of clean energy was supposed to offset the 4,000 megawatts of dirty coal and make the project okay. So then Ex-Im said, look, we're making it better, and approved the project, which is a gross misunderstanding of how the project works.
Now, for any listeners who don't know, can you just tell us in a nutshell, what is the U.S. Export-Import Bank and why are U.S. tax dollars in play?
So the U.S. Export-Import Bank finances overseas business. So it can do a lot of different types of financing. It can do financing with banks, it can do financing of expertise. With Sisan, it's really the classic example where the U.S. Export-Import Bank is actually financing mining equipment. So the U.S. Export-Import Bank provides money to Reliance Power, which is behind the Sisan coal plant and the mine. And then Sisan buys mining equipment from Bucyrus. And that equipment, I believe, is coming from Wisconsin. And then Reliance pays that money back to the U.S. government. So what we're doing is we're, in theory, helping, well, this is the way the Export-Import Bank would put it, is that they're promoting U.S. businesses abroad. The problem is that that is still taxpayer money. Assuming the project is successful, it will be repaid with interest to the U.S. Export-Import Bank. But those are our tax dollars that are financing this project and that are supporting it. What's also troubling is that U.S. Export-Import Bank, or really any export credit agency from any country that's supporting a project like this, it's a vote of confidence in the project. So when the U.S. Export-Import Bank goes and approves a project like Sisan, it's a signal to the private sector that this is a good investment. In theory, Ex-Im shouldn't be financing something that's risky. So all of a sudden, you have other private financiers that are going to be more secure in getting involved in the project. So it also can be used to leverage financing from other sources.
Now, you mentioned Reliance Power. I've learned that the Sisan mega project is owned by that company, which is part of a business conglomeration owned by Anil Ambani. The families of the two Ambani brothers are listed as the second richest family in the world. The Ambanis are something like India's Koch brothers, I guess you could say. Now, why has India, a country so blessed with solar power resources, decided to build unbelievably large coal plants.
For that, you might have to go and ask the Indian government. The truth is that there is this idea about the way power works. It's an idea that is fostered by industry. It's also has been fostered by development associations, although that's changing very rapidly. The idea comes from the way the U.S., Europe, and other Western countries develop. And this is, you know, using technology in the 1800s that was very reliant on coal. So there's this idea that everyone has to develop starting with coal. The problem is that then you're regulating societies to technology from, if not the 1800s, at least the 1900s. These super efficient coal plants are projects that were built in the U.S. in the 1970s. We have the ability now to leapfrog technology. You wouldn't expect to solve the world's telecommunications problems by running landlines everywhere. You know, we skip that step, and in many parts of the world, go straight to cell phones. The same thing could be said with energy, this idea that we have to rely on these dirty sources. The other thing about centralized projects is you really have to look at who they benefit. There's this idea that a centralized coal plant can be built to benefit those who live without energy, which in India is a very real problem. The thing is that centralized coal plants, if you look at the numbers, don't actually do that much to help rural energy poverty. The problem is that to actually address that with a centralized project, you need to deal with the grid. And the grid in India and in many countries is in very bad condition. You have huge losses. And grid extensions are very, very expensive. So you have people who don't have access to electricity, and there's no one who really wants to spend the money to run the grid out to them because that costs money, and that power instead can be sent right into industrial centers. And those are really the people who benefit, are the big industrialists, because they're the ones who are actually getting the power from these projects. And lest you believe that when I'm talking about rural energy poverty, it's people who live a long way from the source. If you go to Singrauli, you see many people who are not connected to the grid. They can live in the shadow of one of these massive coal plants, and they're still not hooked up because there's no company that wants to run a grid 50 feet outside the power project to a small home when they can get so much more money running it hundreds of miles into an industrial center.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm talking with Nicole Gill. And Sierra Club just teamed up with four other NGOs to publish a report titled The U.S. Export-Import Bank's Dirty Dollars. The subtitle reads, U.S. tax dollars are supporting human rights, environment, and labor violations at the Sasan coal-fired power plant and mine in India. Who are the other groups that teamed up with you for this investigative report?
350.org, Carbon Market Watch, Pacific Environment, and Friends of the Earth U.S.
Nicole Gill, it astounds me that the Sasan coal plant has qualified as a clean development mechanism, or CDM, under the Kyoto Protocol. What does that mean, and how is that justified?
It was justified under the idea that Sasan would be a highly efficient coal plant. And again, as I said earlier, these highly efficient coal plants are things that we were building in the U.S. in the 1970s. It's not necessarily super new technology. But the argument was made that by using efficient technology, we'd actually be reducing emissions over using a subcritical technology. There's a number of problems with that. One is, in many parts of the world, the economics of coal actually make super ultra-critical coal plants more economic because you are generating the same amount of electricity by burning less coal. In the U.S., because coal was so cheap, that wasn't always the case. But in a country like India, where they're relying on imported coal, and where there's this vast shortage of domestic coal, they can't dig it up fast enough, all of a sudden these highly efficient coal plants become the go-to as opposed to something that a company might not want to do. The other problem is just the way the coal mechanism was set under the CDM. It vastly, vastly overestimated emission savings. And because of Sasan and other projects, and because attention was drawn to this, the mechanism under the CDM was actually suspended. And since then, it has been re-implemented. So it is technically possible, again, to get coal credits under the CDM, which is absurd. But no project has been approved for carbon credits under the CDM since that change. And that's because, just like you said, it's crazy that a project like this would actually be given carbon credits.
It's not environmentally friendly. Now, the Prime Minister of India, Narendra Modi, did not attend the recent climate change meeting of world leaders in New York City. Is he also dedicated to this vision of coal power for India?
Modi has come with an all of the above approach. He's really said that coal is going to be part of the solution. It has been interesting, though. He's also put a lot of weight behind solar. And I think this is a big shift for India. Every 5 years, you have a new energy plan. And all we said, we're going to build all this coal and we're going to solve energy poverty in India. And it kept not happening. Because, again, these centralized coal plants are very bad at delivering energy access. And for the first time, when you look at India's energy plan under Modi, you're starting to see a huge investment in rooftop solar and in off-grid renewables and clean sources of energy. And the reason for this is that it's purely pragmatic. Modi realizes that to stay in power, he needs to actually put some sort of dent in the levels of energy poverty in India. Centralized coal plants have failed, and there is a model that shows that renewable energy and off-grid and mini-grids can succeed. Now, that being said, Modi is still a big fan of coal. He comes from Gujarat, one of the other ultra-mega power projects that's being built in India. The Tata Mundra plant is in Gujarat as well. So he's definitely a fan of coal. But the reality is finally starting to sink in. And people are starting to realize if you're going to tackle energy poverty, you really have to be looking at these other solutions.
But won't India itself be hit hard by climate change?
Yes. And in fact, its next door neighbor, Bangladesh, is actually one of the countries that will be hit hardest in the entire world because much of that country is below sea level. India, you're dealing with the monsoons and so many people relying on the monsoons for crops, as well as the number of floods that have happened already in India. These flash floods that have killed thousands of people, largely at the base of the mountains. So we're already seeing people die from climate change in India. But at the same time, there is a very real issue of energy poverty and this question of how to juggle it. And it's not going to get better. If all these coal projects are built, you will see more people die.
But it's a huge problem for all of us. I mean, if India, it's the second most populous country in the world, it's projected to become the world's most populous place. If they choose coal as the way to go, we're all going to be in for a climate catastrophe. That's the fear that I have and that I know many of my listeners have.
I think one thing to remember is that while there are a huge number of coal projects in the pipeline for India, the economics are changing because India does have to address its issues with energy poverty, and no one's going to argue with that. The two big questions, well, the three big questions are climate change, but also what is the best way, what is the most efficient way to address energy poverty, and we've already talked a little bit about that, and also what's feasible. And you look at India and look at their coal projects and you're seeing scandals, you're seeing economic instability, and these are things that are really starting to shake up the common beliefs around coal. There was this assumption for so long that coal is cheap, that coal is a good investment, and it was like gravity. That's just the way the world operates. But when you look at India, you're seeing a large number of plants that were proposed to be built on the coast, relying on imported coal, but the price of coal in the international market turned out to be too high for many of those projects. To use Tata Mundra as an example again, this is a project that was on the verge of bankruptcy, and they actually had to go to the Indian government and ask for permission to charge customers a higher rate to cover their costs. And that's gone through the courts, and more recently they've actually been denied that, which puts the entire project's viability into question. For projects like Sasan that are relying on domestic coal, there's been a huge Coalgate scandal that swept across India where coal allotments were basically just given away to the private sector. So the government lost out on huge amounts of money because of that. Now, the coal blocks for the ultra mega power plants, these six or so projects like Sasan, those have been exempted from that ruling, but we're talking about over 200 coal blocks. These are domestic mining rights within India. The court has said should be canceled, and the country is trying to figure out what that means. So the entire coal industry in India is really teetering on the edge. And again, what it's showing is that this preconceived notion that coal is cheap, that coal is a good investment, it's just not true anymore. And once we finally accept that coal is not the answer, then we can start talking about things that really can help solve the problem.
As we finish up, is there a blog or website where people can keep track of the work of Sierra Club India?
Yes. So the Sierra Club's international climate campaign, we don't actually have an office in India, but you can find us through the website www.sierraclub.org, We also have a blog called Compass. That's for this whole Sierra Club, but you can look at the international work that we're doing, and not just in India. Because we don't have boots on the ground in other countries, we partner with grassroots organizations, oftentimes grassroots organizations working in frontline communities affected by these projects, and we offer support where we can. How we got involved in SASAN was really working with people in India who started telling us about what was happening at this project on the ground. And this report is our effort to bring those voices to the forefront, voices that have often been ignored. And we've done a lot of work in other countries around the world. So if you look at www.sierraclub.org and the Sierra Club blog Compass, you'll find that information.
So I'll put links to all these resources in my own show blog at ecoshock.info. We've been talking with Sierra Club campaigner Nicole Guillo. Thank you so much, Nicole.
Thank you. It's great being here.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. Tired of cheerleaders and phony media issues?
We treat climate change almost as if it's something external. It's a sort of problem that we've created that we can solve with human genius. But I don't think it is. I think climate change is our society. Climate change is who we are.
Looking for the awful truth? Dig in with Alex Smith.
Actually, you're never going to get millions of people on the streets to campaign against climate change because they'll be campaigning against their own way of life. And so we're all complicit in that system. The voters are complicit, the corporations are complicit, the politicians are complicit, and we might want to stop climate change, but actually I don't think that we can, at least within the timescale that's apparently available to us. And I think we need to be honest about that, because only when we're honest about that can we start to think about what we do next.
Top scientists, authors, and activists, the ones you want to hear. No fear, Deep Green Radio EcoShock. Join us.